Yeah, thanks. So everyone refreshed. I met Steve, had a real good question he was asking, and the gentleman from Spain was talking about similar experiences as Magna Carta among the fueros of Spain. And if there are other questions, or we can continue the discussion.
Steve, maybe we can hear some of these.
Yeah, Steve.
The point that you were making about the Magna Carta, Peter, those of us who are trying to study the history of port cities within England, and I'm tying this in with the charter that was granted to Liverpool and the charter that was granted to Bristol. There seems to be a historic and constitutional point made that port cities in particular were outside of the Magna Carta, that in fact the mariner would be forever the bondsman of the sea, which means that at any time he would be called up under license of death by the king or queen. And that a day after the signing of the Magna Carta, because King John signed it as the King of Ireland, it was then transported across to Ireland, which had already been colonised by England in 1172. And that's one of the reasons Liverpool was given its charter, because it was a beachhead for the colonisation of Ireland. Now, you can then read the Magna Carta in a way that it becomes a document for the beginning of British imperialism. What we're witnessing in that document is the beginnings of the British Empire, which had already started in 1172 with the colonisation of Ireland. And I think it's that duality and ambiguity about the Magna Carta which would make some of us feel quite ill at ease, really. Because it could be deemed as well as the beginnings and a coming together and a consolidation of English state power. Comments on that?
What?
Would you like to comment on that?
No, thanks.
No, I think it's a very serious, a very important question. I think it's a really deep one. And to me, there's two sides to what I hear. First is the exclusion of mariners, you know, the perpetual enslavement of the mariner.
The need of a mariner. At one time we needed mariners.
Well,
we're fine.
Yeah, let me just, I'm going to, maybe later you can pose that as a question, but for me, I'm answering it in my own way, which is, no, I don't mind the interruption, I'm just saying I'm going to give my own answer, because I have a different we, perhaps, than the one I heard you say. I want to get back to what Steve said, and his we has to do with the mariner, and the mariner is an international figure, you know, enslaved or not. And I was just thinking, you know, what is the mariner today? You know, who are the crews on the very large crude carriers, you know, that bring the world's hydrocarbon energy resources to North America? You know, who are on these crews of the ships bringing goods from across the Pacific or the Atlantic? So it's a very serious question about the nature of our class, or what I would say. And I don't, you know, have a comment other than to praise and hail the dock workers of San Francisco who went out today for 8 hours for May Day. They were joined by their brothers and sisters and family for 1 hour today at the ports in Iraq. The tradition of the sailors' internationalism and solidarity with the working class movement against state power, against capitalism, is one that I think we all need to be reminded of because it's generally invisible. And it takes people such as the shop stewards, the dock workers of Liverpool, with a very long history, to remind us of this. This is why I honor this question, and I consider it a deep one. And I don't have I don't have a simple answer for it at all. I am not in. Okay. Then the second part of the question had to do with the foundations of English imperialism, and I couldn't agree more that the Magna Carta has played a very big role in the history of imperialism. And I would like to see a history of Magna Carta in its relationship to the development and expansion and the genocidal work of British imperialism. I'd like to see that. I think Steve also called our attention to what he called the duality of Magna Carta. It has two sides. Because in addition to the empire, now this is not what he says, but this is my comment, that those who have been colonized also read Magna Carta and think about it and wonder, in Jamaica or in South Africa or in Canada or in Virginia or New York, people are thinking, what does this Magna Carta mean to us, those who have been colonized? And here, just like, say, the U.S. Constitution will be used by slaves, and will be modified by slaves, by African-American slave labor, to be amended in the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. Amendments which draw on Magna Carta in order for that to happen. I will argue that Magna Carta is an African-American liberation document. And I'm competent to make that argument, and I'm willing to run it down from... It's before Granville Sharp. You know, I tried to argue once it begins here in Bristol with Francis, back in the 1640s. But I think it's easier to see on the 4th of July, 1770. I mention the 4th of July because Americans know that as the date they declared independence from King George III, declaring independence at the same time declaring war. Magna Carta is a different kind of document. It doesn't start a war, it ends a war. It's an armistice. Armistice between contending forces. The Declaration of Independence, I think, was a part of American imperialism. You know, who was going to get the Ohio Valley? Who was going to get the wood and timber? It had been incited by Magna Carta and by Tom Paine. That is the American Declaration of Independence. That's 1776. July 4th, 1770 is when Thomas Lewis escapes slavery in the River Thames and that a writ of habeas corpus is obtained for his emancipation, for his manumission. That led up to the Somerset case. So to me, you heard earlier how the 11th of September is an important date to me, same with the 4th of July. But I give a new meaning to the 4th of July now, not for a genocidal expansion into the Ohio Valley, which the Declaration of Independence enabled. It did some other things as well. Sorry, I lost my thought. I lost my train of thought. But in the 20th century, so Steve, I agree that, and I would say, that there's parts of Magna Carta that has lived, within the struggle. That duality comes from a contest. I think I told Steve or somebody during the break that Magna Carta is not just between the king and nobles. It's also between the church and the monarchy. It's also between the Christian and the Jew. It's also between the husband and the wife. It's also between the merchant and the feudal lord. It's also between the commoner and the privatizer. Now, you're not going to find in those 63 chapters verbatim references to those seven elements of the social contract that was signed for state power in Britain to get its start. And then during the whole tyrannies of the Tudors and Stuarts, Magna Carta was forgotten. You know, Shakespeare wrote The Life and Death of King John. He never refers to anything I refer to. He doesn't even refer to Magna Carta in that play. Instead, in the center of the play is a scene of torture. You know, he's writing under one of the strongest and most vicious terror regimes that the world knows. The reign of Queen Elizabeth I and her father, Henry VIII. 50,000 people hanged.
And the men she was surrounded by.
Beg your pardon?
And the men she was surrounded by.
Yes, and the men she was surrounded by. It's a class rule, and the class rule is the centralized monarchy of the Tudor. You know, when Charles I is executed, part of the terms of his punishment is his violation of the Great Charters of England. This is important to remember in America, where the people are interested in the impeachment of George Bush. Should George Bush be executed? Should his head be chopped off? That's the question that the historic experience in England poses. Magna Carta itself says if King John violates it, they doesn't say his head should be chopped off. They say, nor does it say he should be hurt. They say all his properties must be returned. It's the principle of reparation, of restorative justice. It's not the principle of destroying the person or the tyrant, who, after all, might change. You know, people in prison change. People grow up and change. Even tyrants can. But they can't do so if they're living in castles and living off the ill-gotten gains of the rest of the world. They must become just like us. You know, another bozo on the bus. And then perhaps they have a chance. So Magna Carta says this of King John and his family, that all his castles, all the forests must be returned, and those of his brother, Richard, and those of his grandfather. I'm not a medievalist. I'm just saying here's a principle of reparations in Magna Carta. Inasmuch as people in the world are looking for arguments about reparations, we can use Magna Carta or not. I don't think there's a law, Steve. I think there are few laws in the class-ridden societies that have preceded us that can escape this duality that you mentioned. What can escape it is the world of those who want nothing to do with the law. You know, who live in a world of custom, who live in a world of a relationship to the land, where people among themselves are sorting out their relations, their gendered relations, their reproductive relations, their relations of property, their relations of personal property, not capitalist property. And they're throughout the world, whether it's the Paiute Indians of Nevada, the Choctaw of Oklahoma, the women of Nigeria, the women protecting the seeds in Bangladesh, the people in Oaxaca, requires a mobilization to retain such customs. And such mobilization can only occur, or so far has occurred, in relationship to the land. This is why that history, the history of indigeneity, is so important to us. So again, Steve, you know, that's my comment.
When we think about rights now, such as rights of habeas corpus and rights of trial by jury, we talk about these rights being universal, rights inalienable, rights available to everyone. When we talk about Magna Carta rights, were these rights that were available to the common people, or were these rights that the nobles and the landowners got for themselves against the king, but didn't get for anyone else? I mean, was it in 1215, were these rights any wider than a few hundred people?
Yeah. I'm sure there are people in this room much wiser than me in answering this question. It's a fundamental question, and people are thinking about it all over the world. You know, and I think, when Karl Marx referred to the 10 Hours Act that was passed in 1848, he said, as opposed to the pompous French Declaration of Rights of Man and the Citizen, here we have a simple Magna Carta of the limitation of hours. And I've been thinking of that line of his, of why did Karl Marx contrast Magna Carta with the pomposity of universal rights? I don't have an answer to that question. Universal rights come in the conditions of commodity production. Magna Carta is born, and the notion of customs of common people is pre-commodity production. I think it's difficult to have universality in times of commodity production, when every product of human labor becomes equal and available for all people. That's not a very good definition of a commodity, but it's what we do when we go to work, is we produce such commodities. And so my thinking so far on this question is first, Magna Carta is not about rights. It's about powers. And then the traditions of social history, such as Professor Steve Poole is an exemplar of, such as our generation in British social history have produced, in agrarian history and many forms of history, has been to show the vibrancy, the vitality of customary relations that are outside the law and are not quite speaking that universality of rights that you mentioned. And I think there might be also something of this perhaps in the history of the mariners that Steve was suggesting. I'm not sure. I think it's a problem that we're facing around the world. I think people are coming up with different answers to it. But Magna Carta talks about powers and prerogatives. It talks about perpetuities. maybe that man in the Forest of Dean can tell us about perpetuities.
You talk about habeas corpus being one of the great things that came and was first mentioned in Magna Carta. Who had the protection of habeas corpus under Magna Carta? Was it everyone who had the protection?
No. I don't think everyone did. Also, habeas corpus is not mentioned in Magna Carta. It's not mentioned. But I mentioned it, didn't I? As if it were. Okay. Mistake.
You lied.
It was misleading.
Was before or?
Well, I thought it was mentioned, but I thought it
was. Yeah, one thinks it is. One thinks it is, but it isn't. I'm telling you the truth. How we came to think in this mistaken way has to do with a petition of right of 1626. How we came to think this way, that habeas corpus was tied to Magna Carta, had to do with a constitutional struggle that took place in England in the 1620s and the 1630s, when the phrases of Chapter 39 were tied to a writ that sheriffs were able to issue, the writ of habeas corpus. Mm-hmm. And the two were tied until that writ became a principle of law. But it was through Magna Carta. And the people who did that are part of the Constitution, part of our constitutional history. When I say our, I mean, I think the whole world's, but especially in England. That history of Edward Cook, that history of the levelers, that history of the parliamentarians that, people in Bristol fought and died for and preserved.
Royalist versus Republican.
Yes, it's a Republican as well, I think, quite so. So you're right. But at the same, what I forgot to mention was Robin Hood.
Which one?
Yeah, there's so many Robin Hoods, huh? It wasn't Bonnie and Clyde. It wasn't Jesse James. But, there's every generation and similar times, like the 1930s, the 1790s, the 1640s. People wonder, who was a Robin Hood? And the best I've come up with is a Robin Hood of 1225. But here are people, they will, and it happened in the struggle for American slaves as well. Habeas corpus, not as a writ, but as direct action. that is invading the courthouse and taking the body of those who have been unjustly and criminally prosecuted under pretense of law, such as Mumia Abu-Jamal. This was the fugitive slave direct actions that began in the 1770s, were like several generations before the American Civil War, that culminated in the American Civil War. The direct action, again, like the fugitive slave, the states of the North were required to return a slave that had run away. In the North, they said this is a violation of habeas corpus. But the Supreme Court might have said it's not, but the people had a different view of the law and would invade the courtroom and do habeas corpus in practice rather than as a writ. You know, so our history is not just the law, it's also our practices that we've done. I hope that's helpful. You know, so, you know, I didn't lie mendaciously, but it's complex. And I think the time has come again for us to see, to produce some more complexities, you know, if we want, on this planet. And we can use habeas corpus, or we can use habeas corpus and Magna Carta if we wish. I don't think it's a communist manifesto, or I don't think it's an anarchist manifesto. But Peter Kropotkin honored the fueros, the charters of different villages, and the customs in different villages of mutual aid and cooperation. And that's my other theme, that that's the trial by jury. Because at one time, the jury in English history was the collective wisdom of the neighborhood as to who has put too many pigs, you know, in the forest for pannage. Or it's not just the adjudication of criminal disputes. Remember, in England, of course, the criminal law is the king's law. It's violation of the king. Pleas of the crown, it's called. But before the Tudor times, all disputes, like shop floor disputes, would be settled by a jury. You know, 12, we would say, 12 good people and true. People that we choose. Now, such assemblies, such neighborhood assemblies, can be found all over the world. But they're not part, I don't think, of the NGO structure or the UN structure. Or I know they're not. And in time of need, we have found new structures, right? Whether it's the congregation or the section or the Soviet or the panchayat in India, you know, we have found assemblies and ways of gathering to solve problems that lead to such inequalities, to such dangers of subsistence for our fellow creatures. And we can do it again. And people are trying to do it again. I you know, I just speak like that because I'm a professor, and the people, the British history people in my country, they had a understandable but limited report on why there's so few people study British history, and they said it's because Western values no longer help you get a job, and the particular values are not good. That's why you study English history, to get a job? For what are those values? What are the particular values? Is Estovers among them? Is protein among them? Is fuel among them? It has been. And is the professional association of British historians no longer aware of this? Do you follow me? I'm not saying I want to go back to Englishness or English nationalism. Don't get me wrong. Or to, you know, white man transatlantic bullshit. You know, the whole world knows what that's about. And I'm not saying we have to go back to Magna Carta either. I'm just wondering. You know, people in the emergency are wondering, what are we going to do? And I'm throwing this out into the mix. And I'm asking you to do it too. Because it's our responsibility. Oh, boy. Too bad I don't drink.
It's interesting, Peter, you talk about us needing to remember these things, to remember Magna Carta in our own way, to make use of it, to remember what it says, or even what it doesn't say, but should say. But if we've forgotten, the interesting, I was just sort of thinking about 19th century radical memory. Mm. Now it seems far less faulty, in quite sort of nuanced, particular ways. I was thinking about, folks here are familiar with this, but the work of William Hone and George Cruikshank at the time of the Peterloo Massacre. They produced these wonderful sort of parodies on sort of English, traditional, well-known folk tales and so on. This is a wonderful, easy to understand parody of the nursery rhyme of the house that Jack built, and they call it the political house that Jack built.
Yes, they do.
And it begins with this classical rotunda. Cruikshank draws the classical rotunda, and it says, "This is the political house that Jack built." And you're invited to sit there and reflect upon this, because it's the political house. The political house of the rotunda is the English Constitution. And it's the three pillars of the Constitution, the Lords, the Commons, the Crown. And they're all supporting liberty. And at the bottom, what holds all this up, the foundations, are some boxes in which are contained as a representation of just kind of wealth. But also the Magna Carta, clearly marked, and the 1689 Bill of Rights, which is, we didn't talk about that, but there's a relationship between the two documents in England, which is interesting, I think. But there's this, sort of put me back in mind of this, that what these radical authors were doing was reminding us that if the Constitution was built, and it's the English Constitution, then it's built upon the foundations of liberty and the Commonwealth, it's the political house that Jack built. It's not a political house they wanted to tell us that was given to us by our rulers. It's not a political house that was developed through institutions. It's not something we have to venerate. We have to remember we made it ourselves. It's Jack is John Bull. Jack is you and I. We made this house. We need to keep it up. Yeah, I mean, their memory wasn't anything like as faulty as ours, because they saw Magna Carta and everything they thought Magna Carta stood for as the thing which we'd made. You know, we made it. Jack made it. Sister.
Thanks, Steve. We're on the same page.
We've got two dates. We wanted to look after each other.
One of the things Steve was talking about earlier on today was that you know, you talk about customary right and, you know, all that kind of aspect of it that lies, that was already in, you know, already happening before the Magna Carta. But it seems to me that you know Magna Carta might be a reflection of sort of, you know, sort of class forces, or you know, or these contested places like in the Commons, or you know, in I don't know, political power or monarchical power, whatever. But is there a truth in saying that, like, the moment that, like, these relationships become, like, transcribed into a document, or, you know, become, like, a recognised, like, the relationship of power is recognised by the rulers, and then they kind of make a compromise and they write it down and it becomes law or something, that's, you know, really... You know, that's really sort of contrary to the idea of customary right, because I mean, it kind of takes the control, or the potential control by people of how, you know, how they operate in the Commons or whatever they want to do in terms of customary right, out of their hands, and kind of puts it up there and takes it out of their kind of schema, really, and that kind of, Steve was suggesting that, you know, it's kind of effectively co-opting it, really. I mean, it changes, you know what I mean? It changes the relationship. You're not, you know, for example, my example would be something like, I don't know, some gentrification dispute where you're saying this building is like a cultural asset, right, and it's really important in the way people use a building. Mm. And, you know, the council, for example, would be talking about, you know, its architectural importance as the only reason it might be protecting it, and the developer is saying, oh, I'm going to make your life great by making shops and houses. The point is that our understanding as people of that building has no basis in law whatsoever. Right, so talking about this building as a cultural asset has no basis in law, okay? But that's a real thing to us as people. So the moment, you know, let's imagine we were very strong and we managed to stop lots of places in Bristol being developed and cultural assets being removed. You know, there would come a point where they would recognise that power, and that might get written into the law. But to a certain extent, I think that probably removed the kind of freedom of movement, because then they'd say, well, now this is the law now. This is the way we interpret it. This is the way that customary right has been interpreted in the Forest Charter, for example. And then that becomes like the ruling idea, rather than the idea that actually where the power comes from is the fact that we, you know, we have a cultural asset, and that's the way we use it, and that's the way we're going to use it. Do you see what I'm getting at? I don't know.
Maybe yeah, I do. I see several things.
Power versus legal power.
Yeah. What?
Democratic power versus legal power.
Versus legal.
Yeah, there's. I think we're dealing with a tension in some areas where they overlap somewhat.
Useful to know the chapters in power.
And I think one thing is a problem of writing. Another one is, I was thinking of Chopper James, right? When the Book of Dennis for the Forest of Dean was when he was chopping down some enclosure for a fence, I believe he used an axe or pickaxe. Do this and a pickaxe and was leading a force to do that. And I think the crown said something to him, don't do that for crown authorities. And he claimed that the axe was his Magna Carta. And this was, and it, perhaps it has something to do. Power does not derive, power, all power doesn't derive from written words. And in this case, the preservation of the commoners and some of the forest customs in Dean was retained by people's force, you know, and I think the analysis of those forces is a job of class analysis. It's a job but also it's a job, I think, of us. You know, when the class is in motion, we like to. I was saying, sometimes we like to think that we're doing things for the sake of the past. We're returning to the past. You know, like Magna Carta itself. Stephen Langton, the Archbishop who wrote it, he said. He called the barons. He said, look, I've discovered a charter. The charter of the barons from 1210. I think many people like to think that they've found something earlier. You know, my people in Nigeria, here's how we settled such things. You know, everybody could have a roof. And the landlord, the king, had to fix the roof. I lost it again. Take that out. So that was one of the issues, writing. The other thing that I think about is, and I don't know if this is right or not, but you have statute law, and you look at, you know, you go to the law office and you take off the statutes of the realm. The first two statutes are the Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest, and they remain that way. Certainly that's true in America. So that's one part of the law, statute, you know, what the parliament passes. The second part of the law is common law, and that's what judges say. But I think judges and legislators tend to belong to the same class, you know, or represent the propertied interest. So it's this customary behavior or customary norms that remain outside of those two things. So common law isn't, you know, the way lawyers said, isn't the law of the commons. And that's where the word gets us into trouble.
I've always been curious about what common law really means. I'm from Spain. In my background, everything related to things similar to Magna Carta are regarded as very primitive and... In our case, it didn't lead to a progressive society or a free society. On the contrary, it led to a very tyrannic society. You know what I think the state is his name, said about Magna Carta and colonization of Ireland. It was happening in Spain a little, even earlier. And it led to the conquer of the Islamic Spain, and then we went to the Americas, and it didn't turn up into a free society. It was a tyranny. And what we are taught at school there is that everything what was erased by the liberalism from the 19th and 18th centuries, and we think that real law comes from there. Common law is something primitive. I mean, take no offense. Yeah, I know we have different traditions, but that's the way we think about it. You can put ideas written in the 12th century in our age. They are fundamental problems, but law has evolved in them. Even Roman law was probably more advanced than the medieval ages legislation. So I don't really understand this kind of worshipping a very basic approach to law and regulation society.
Yeah.
Especially if coming from the United States, the American Constitution was the first modern constitution. And all the Enlightenment and, you know, it's far more advanced than...
You know, the American Constitution was founded to monopolize violence and money in one small class of slaves, bankers, merchants, and manufacturers. You read James Madison's Federalist Paper number 10, calling on Americans to ratify the U.S. Constitution. That's his argument. The factions of the ruling class must stop quarreling. We need to have a constitution. That's why it's a modern constitution, because it recognizes the divisions in the ruling class, and it says we need a constitution to sort them out. Why did they have that problem? Why did the property class have that problem? The answer is that the unpropertied were beginning to seize power and to take power and to be curious all over the Atlantic world. That's the origins of the U.S. Constitution. Says its, quote, founder, James Madison. It's the truth. You know, we can look it up. We can read the Federalist Papers. It leaves the unpropertied out. It leaves out the women. It leaves out the mariners. It leaves out the cotton plantation workers, the slaves. You know, if you're a historian, you have to take the long view. And the Constitution of the Unpropertied has yet to be written. You know, and maybe you're right. Maybe it should never be written. But it's hard for me to say that looking at Guantanamo. It's hard for me to say that to the people who have been arrested and are incarcerated in what's a carceral society now, the U.S. Empire. So we have to look for the little cracks in the system to use. And maybe those cracks can grow. Like with Spanish law. In the American Southwest, the native people are able to use Spanish law to preserve water rights. You know? So those fueros, primitive as they may be, and with due respect, I tend not to use the word primitive, but rather use the word primary.
Yeah.
You know, because it reminds me, who am I as a human being? You know, to me, whether it's the parable of the Good Samaritan, whether it's the slogan of liberty, equality, and fraternity, or humanity, is a basis of equality that we fight for. The unfairness of permitting a city to destroy itself, if Katrina, basic unfairness. Some people have too much money.
Mm-hmm.
Some people's greed, a class in this world of greed. You know, speaking formally, I want the principle of reparation and restorative justice returned. And I'm not quite sure how to fight it or how to do it, but it has been done in the past. The particular values, you know, it's not like freedoms are not, they're not always there. You know, when that Society of British Historians said the particular values won't get you a job, okay, but what have been the particular values? There are only a few times in human history when we particularize. You know, in the time of the Fueros was one. The time of the French Revolution was another. The time of the 1930s was a third. You know, and perhaps we can find others when we need to begin particularizing. What do we want as human beings? And how are we going to do this? I'm getting too excited. But you know what I'm saying is the truth. You know when you see that picture of that woman gathering escovers, which she may sell, she may use, or spread among her family. You compare that, or I compare that with how I cook at home, how we cook at home. And I'm glad I don't have to spend 2 or 3 hours a day foraging for wood. Man, yeah.
I'm not choosing to disagree with you with any of the political statements. I'm just looking at the lessons we can learn from Magna Carta.
Yeah.
And he talks about how the American Constitution was really a settlement between the interests of the ruling classes,
right,
rather than an assistance to those who run properties.
Right.
With Magna Carta, was that a settlement of interest between the ruling classes, between the king and the landowning barons? Or to what extent did it give rights and support and assistance to those who are unpropertied?
Those who are unpropertied have fought to appear in Magna Carta. You know, that story I told you of William Morris, he learned it from some 14th century peasants. How did they know it? Why did the commons appear between 1215 and 1217? You know, why was Chapter 7 amended? There was a struggle that took place in those years to force that emendation. And I'm using that emendation for our own purposes, if we wish, using principles of legal hermeneutics that Edward Cook did, you know, when he got habeas corpus and put it into Magna Carta. The Charter of the Forest establishes some principle of human subsistence that's not based upon privatization. Okay, I've seen the damage that privatization has done, as we have. So I'm interested in some other principle, gentlemen.
I was quite interested in the Charter of the Forest, and as you talked about how Magna Carta came to be written, the Charter of the Forest sort of appeared a bit later, and how did that come about? Who wrote it, and what? Who was it an agreement between? I mean, it just suddenly seemed to appear. So, you know, where did it come from?
I don't know. I don't know. I read J.C. Holt or go.
We're not going to tell you anything you don't know already. But the funny thing is that about the whole Charter of the Forest, it seems to stem from the fact that the forest was protected as raw hunting land, and the privileges in some way seem to stem from the fact that it was a royal preserve, which is, I know you've just written a leaf up, but the beans on telling you you don't know, but it's, and you know, within the struggle in Forest of Dean and elsewhere, there's an appeal to the king, not against the king. It's often, it's the key, who's the good person.
Yeah, in fairy tales too. It's important that.
But
in fairy tales, the king is always like someone you can appeal to.
But even the majority of English rebellions and revolts, they're often appealing to the good king as against his bad advisors. They don't actually challenge that, the power, you know, God's representative on earth. They don't take it that far. That's what, at least, you know, most of what I've read seems to lead to.
I think the British historian and medievalist who is most thorough, to my knowledge, is J.C. Holt. And I've studied his revised and second edition on Magna Carta and haven't found an answer to your question. And I think this is it's a task definitely for us historians in Britain to do, is to find out what is the story of the Charter of the Forest. Otherwise, it's going to remain as a, if not a fairy tale, as a Hollywood operation with Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if we want it into anything else, we either have to change Robin Hood or find out the answer to your question. Is you know, for sure in England, you know, with English history, you know, we're called empiricists, which means you can't say anything, which means we basically photocopy the archives. And if you're going to get anywhere, you have to find something in the archives that someone else didn't find. That's empiricism at its worst. But history is more than just photocopying the archive, because we know there's a politics to archives, just as there's a politics to the charters. You know, they wanted them.
I just wanted to say something about what you just said about the relations of power between the crown, between Steve and I, next week. But yeah, okay, you might see appeals to the good king, you might see appeals to monarchy. I walked down the street the other day with a banner saying don't develop Stokes Croft, right? Right, and that's a demand, okay? And it could be, I could be asking, I could be going to council meeting and saying, you know, I really think that, you know, what you're doing here is wrong because you need to think about, you know, it might be very reasonable. In fact, I might even be, you know, the fact that I'm appealing to civic power, right, can be read as like, oh, you know, Roger thinks civic power's great and he thinks it's really democratic and he's following the process. And yeah, to a certain extent, that's true. But I'm also not an idiot either. And like, because people made appeals to the monarchy or write things down like that, does not mean that they do not understand the relations of force that are involved in that, you know, and that they will start on the process. Like, I don't think many people decide to go to armed struggle to get a property dispute sorted out immediately, right? But in the world, armed struggle does happen when people follow a process. So the point about power relations is that you can read them. I mean, for example, in, you know, Chiapas in 1993, people walked through the streets of San Cristobal, like indigenous peasants, saying, you know, demanding their rights to common land and to health and education. You know, and that was a demonstration, and you could read that and say, oh, yeah, this is really interesting. The Chiapan peasants, they believe in civic power, and they kind of believe in local democracy. Well, within 1 year, they were fighting an armed struggle. So it's very, I would be careful about reading relations of force in medieval times purely on the basis of like appeals to the king.
Okay, I mean but they would challenge the local lord in that way, i.e. they would rebel against him physically.
The property developer.
Yeah, the property developer. Yeah.
So they appeal.
I think
to
you're
the
right.
Power,
I don't disagree with what you're saying. Yeah. Just because, you know.
Well, if the council says, yeah, okay, stop it, you're not going to turn these clubs into flats, fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But if they don't, then the relations of force will expose themselves, you know, in different ways. Like.
Anyone have a copy of the book?
Yes.
Here? Anyone? Let's buy some of these books. I'll tell you a story to end my thing. During the Peasants' Revolt, St. Albans, in 1381, right? When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? You all know that one? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the slogan from the Peasants' Revolt of 1381.
What was it?
When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? The peasants in St. Albans went to the scriptorius, I forget the Latin, but the guy in the monastery who was the head writer, you know, taught other people to write. And the peasants said, we want all the charters you have in there, and we're going to have a bonfire. And they burned them. So it's like the French Revolution. But then they said, you have one charter in there that we want. It's the charter in blue and gold. And we don't want to burn it, because in that charter is our some of our rights are recognized. Some of our power, we are acknowledged, or we are seen. And these illiterate peasants had seen the letters, and it of blue and gold. And I say to myself, well, those writers in there, where did they get those inks to make blue and gold? You know, They didn't have those dyes. Gold comes from gold. And it came either from Russia or Africa. You know, in 1381. So who's ever making the inks there were hooked up with some other people relating to Africa for the writing of these. And the blue, where did the blue come from? Where? Yes, exactly. From Persia or Afghanistan. Beautiful, huh? So it's more like looking at the written record as a materiality. And then it's just a simple step to imagine, you know, people from around the world cooperating to make that happen.
Let's do it again.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you.